Oil prices are up too due to the turmoil in the Middle East and North Africa. OPEC countries supply around 40% of the world's oil. After violence erupted in Libya, the price of a barrel shot up to heights not seen in over 2 years. That's despite the fact that oil is still flowing there. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, even a perceived ripple in the oil industry creates waves all over the world.
Oil experts like Phil Verlager, an economist at the University of Calgary, are quoting Yogi Berra lately as in it's deja vu all over again. Verlager is thinking about the political convulsions in Iran, Kuwait, and Iraq that have caused oil prices to gyrate since the 1970s. This time, Libya is in trouble. Sure, if all Libyan wells shut down, that's only 2% of the world's oil. But Verlager says not all oil is created equal.
Now, it happens that the Libyan crude has almost no sulfur and produces a great deal of diesel fuel per barrel of crude, which means it's very valued. One can think of it like fat-free milk.
Libyan oil is light and sweet. It's the kind that refineries want for making low-sulfur diesel and jet fuel. Europe uses a lot of diesel. The U.S. makes a lot of jet fuel. And both markets require low-sulfur fuel because it pollutes less. Okay, so the Saudi Arabians have several million barrels a day of excess capacity. But Saudi oil isn't light and sweet. It's heavy and sour.
So the loss of the Libyan crudes may not be easily replaced by just boosting Saudi production. In theory, you might need 4 barrels of Saudi crude for 2 barrels of Libyan crude to get the same amount of diesel. But if you don't have the capacity to take out the sulfur, the Saudi crude is useless.
The good news is more refineries are set up to remove that sulfur now. As Charles Drevna explains, he's the head of the National Petrochemical and Refiners Association, refineries are retooling to expand their options.
Most companies are trying to use a wider array of crudes, being able to process those. That's why there's been a lot of modifications to refineries.
But will they be able to get their hands on enough oil in the first place? Jim Burkhardt at Cambridge Energy Research Associates says right now, worldwide demand is galloping ahead. It's largely driven by economic growth in China and India.
When you have an environment of strong global economic growth, and then you have a supply crisis, even if it is just 2% of global supply, it's increasing anxiety.
That anxiety is also driven by the fact that the trip from oil pump to gas pump is a long and winding road. Pipelines, seaports, tanker fleets, refineries, and the workers who run them are all over the Middle East and North Africa, and thus at risk from disruption.
That is one reason why the unrest in Egypt created anxiety in the oil market. Egypt's a net importer of oil, but it is a key transit point.
And anxiety drives panicky buying, even hoarding, by institutions that use a lot of fuel, like state governments or airlines. Severin Borenstein is an oil economist at the University of California at Berkeley. He says fear of higher oil prices can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
They see the chance that oil is going to be disrupted in the next month or two. And they get in and try to either through the futures markets or through bilateral contracts lock in prices. And as more of them do that, it drives up the price.
There is a safety valve at hand if gas prices skyrocket. 700 million barrels or so of oil in the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve alone. An infusion from the reserve might only be a psychological balm, but then psychology is a big part of what drives the oil market. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Earlier this month, the president announced plans to cut $1.1 trillion from the deficit over 10 years. Many mayors and other locally elected officials are greatly concerned about one proposal, cuts to the long-standing community development block grant programs. NPR's Alex Kellogg reports that even some Republicans oppose the move.
Roughly 1,200 cities and counties in the U.S. receive community development block grants, also known as CDBGs. They fund everything from affordable housing to job creation programs. The government gave out nearly $4 billion in block grants last year. Most of that money went directly to cities and counties. President Barack Obama is now proposing a cut of roughly $300 million. Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett, a Republican, opposes the cuts.
There's outrage. There's panic. There's the situation that, you know, we've got to stop whatever it is we're doing and be heard on this particular issue at this particular time.
Democrats and Republicans at the local level say such cuts will only hurt cash-strapped communities. But the cuts could go even further if congressional Republicans have their way. Many Republicans are pushing for a cut of roughly $2.5 billion. Cornett is the president of Republican mayors and local officials. his city received $7.1 million in block grant money in the last fiscal year alone. So he was in Washington, D.C. this week to meet with White House officials, at the top of his agenda, pushing back on the proposed cuts. On Thursday, he joined 30 U.S. mayors who urged Congress not to move forward. Cornett admits that on this issue, Republicans at the local and national level don't see eye to eye.
They have heard me year in and year out. This is an annual issue. Throughout the Bush White House years, we were receiving, you know, small cuts in CDBG. And so I know there's not a single representative for the state of Oklahoma who doesn't already know how the mayor of Oklahoma City feels.
Block grants were created by President Gerald Ford in 1974. They were preceded by a more complex, competitive grant process considered far less efficient. Local officials across the country say despite their effectiveness, they're persistently singled out for cutbacks. Ron Loveridge is the mayor of Riverside, California. He says, given the sagging economy, this is the worst possible time to take money away from cash-strapped communities.
At the very time where you need this sort of help, particularly for disadvantaged members of the community, the opposite is taking place.
Last year alone, Riverside used millions in block grant money for park upgrades, housing developments, and street improvements. But congressional Republicans argue the government is out of money and can't keep passing the nation's massive debt on to future generations. House Republican Roscoe Bartlett of Maryland.
We have got to make cuts. This is totally unsustainable, and business as usual is just not an option now.
The National League of Cities doesn't see it that way. Jim Hunt is a council member in the small town of Clarksburg, West Virginia. He's also a past president of the NLC.
The one thing that Republicans and Democrats have generally joined together is to say that CDBG is a worthy program and one that shouldn't be cut.
The group is not giving up. During the congressional recess this week, the NLC urged mayors and other local officials to continue to lobby their lawmakers. Alex Kellogg, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
At the heart of Republican rhetoric in Wisconsin, as well as in Ohio and Indiana, is a contention about finances. The Republicans say public sector workers are overcompensated compared to private sector workers. But is that true? Dan Bobkoff is with the reporting project Changing Gears about the industrial Midwest, and he explains it depends on whom you ask.
Okay, just to be clear, we're not talking here just about wages, but retirement, health care, and other benefits. Gary Chasen is a labor relations professor at Clark University.
A large part of what we're hearing out of Wisconsin now is about shared sacrifice and equality of sacrifice. The feeling that the public sector workers' unions haven't really done their share.
Call it jealousy or resentment. Many think that those who work for the government get too generous a deal. With high unemployment and years of recession, it's governors and legislatures who now have the political capital to try to seek concessions. But is it true that many government workers have a cushy gig? On one side, there are researchers like Jeffrey Keefe of Rutgers University, who says when you add up all the pay and retirement plans and other benefits, public sector workers are,
for the most part, paid at market or slightly below market.
Precisely 3.7% less by his calculation. But these are just averages because there are a lot of jobs in government that just don't exist in the private sector, like, say, prison warden. So apples-to-apples comparisons aren't easy. And people like E.J. McMahon of the Manhattan Institute disagree with Keefe's claim.
I think the research is pretty clear that total compensation in the public sector is greater than total compensation in the private sector.
McMahon says a guaranteed pension is a whole lot better than a risky 401k. Public sector workers also tend to get much cheaper and better health plans, even in retirement. That leads many government workers to retire earlier, which has another effect on these comparisons. It drives down average public sector salaries as younger workers replace the retirees. Of course, there's also more job security in government. It's hard to put a dollar figure on this kind of intangible, but Jeffrey Keefe says it's often a trade-off.
Yeah, job security has some benefit to it. But at the other time, you have to work in a large bureaucratic organization, which is probably a negative.
Union membership in America has been declining for years, especially in the private sector. Today, about 36% of the public sector is organized versus under 7% in the corporate world. That varies wildly across the country, though. According to Professor Barry Hirsch of Georgia State University, nearly half of Wisconsin and Ohio's public sector workers are in a union. Now, compare that to a state like North Carolina, where that number is under 10%. Donald Grimes of the University of Michigan says from 2000 to 2009, public sector compensation went up about 42% versus 32% in the private sector. But there was a surprise.
It's not particularly pronounced for Wisconsin or Ohio or Indiana, at least among Great Lakes states. Their wages and benefits have not gone up that much.
So the states that are ground zero now for this battle over unions and compensation buck the national trend. Private sector salaries actually rose more in Wisconsin than government pay. In Ohio, there wasn't much difference between public and private compensation over that period. But Grimes says no matter what numbers you believe or what study you cite, taxes paid by private sector workers just can't support all these pensions and retiree health plans.
In some sense, it almost doesn't matter if you're getting paid more or less than you deserve. If there's just no money there, you're going to get paid less.
And that's one reason why everything is bubbling over now. For NPR News, I'm Dan Bobkoff.
This is NPR.
The stalemate in Wisconsin and other Midwestern states between Republican governors and organized labor is about much more than pay, benefits, and collective bargaining. Unions contend that their very existence is threatened by what is called right-to-work legislation. The laws make union membership optional for many workers. Republican officials argue that limiting union strength not only helps keep government costs down, it helps create new jobs. NPR's David Shaper explores the accuracy of that statement.
Almost to a person, the tens of thousands of people who have been shouting and marching at the Wisconsin State Capitol for almost 2 weeks now believe the legislation being pushed by Republican Governor Scott Walker has less to do with saving money than breaking unions.
I feel it's a total attack.
Joe Nigro is the National General Secretary Treasurer of the Sheet Metal Workers Union.
I see it as a national campaign.
Nigro says every union in both the public and private sectors is under attack. He says while few are going as far and as fast as Walker is in taking on Wisconsin's unions, other Republican governors are preparing to follow Walker's lead. In addition to eliminating many collective bargaining rights for most state and local government workers, Walker's bill could significantly weaken Wisconsin's public employee unions because teachers, prison guards, nurses, social workers, and other public employees would no longer be required to join their unions. They would vote each year on whether to keep their union, and they would no longer have the union dues automatically deducted from their paychecks.
For some of our workers in the state, that's going to mean up to $1,000 that no longer is automatically forcibly taken out of their paycheck.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker.
That's real money. That's money that those households can use to help offset that pension contribution and the health care contribution. That's real money that helps the bottom line.
Walker's legislation would essentially make Wisconsin a right-to-work state for public employees. Indiana is already a right-to-work state for public employees, and Republicans there tried this week to make it right-to-work for the private sector, too. There are similar proposals in Ohio, Michigan, and other industrial states that are losing manufacturing jobs. Just as in Indiana, Republicans there argue that limiting unions will help attract new factories and jobs. A Wall Street Journal analysis this week compared six upper Midwestern states with strong union protections with six Sunbelt right-to-work states. It showed greater job losses and slower wage growth over the last decade in the pro-union states than in the right-to-work states. But some economists question that comparison, saying there are stark differences between the economies of the industrial North and the more rural South, where wages were lower to begin with. Laura Dresser is a labor economist with the Center on Wisconsin Strategy.
You know, I think the best rigorous research on the question of living standards in right-to-work versus non-right-to-work states shows a 3% wage loss for living in a right-to-work state, a wage penalty to being in a place that doesn't have unions.
As for bringing in new jobs, Dresser notes, there have been some big employers choosing to locate in right-to-work states for their cheaper labor costs. Foreign car makers, for example, have opened plants in Tupelo and Tuscaloosa, not in Flint and Toledo. But Dresser says most businesses look at more than just labor costs.
The broadest and strongest evidence suggests that employers are looking for good workers. That takes good schools. They're looking for good infrastructure. That takes money for roads and rails. They're looking for cities where they can have suppliers and relationships with other businesses. And all those things tend to happen in not-to-right-to-work states.
In addition, the most significant job growth over the past decade has been in high immigration states. Dresser says that includes both right-to-work states and strong union states, such as New York and California. David Shaper, NPR News.